your policy, but housing policy, a whole slew of other areas that we see as root causes of hunger. So OregonFoodBank.org is the place to go. And yeah, we have those events pretty regularly. There's ways to get engaged to volunteer, pick up a shift for repacking, and either in our headquarters in Northeast or in one of our regional food bank partners organizations across the state. We partner with 1,400 different organizations across the state, and getting engaged in any part of the state you live in is a possibility.
Great. Well, Lauren, thanks so much for being on Prison Pipeline.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be
misunderstood. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO. In accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Meetings are held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify that a meeting is being held.
Hey everybody, it's Marky Ramon here. How you doing? Catch me this Tuesday on the Ghost of Hollywood on KBOO 90.7 FM, and check out my show on October 9th at the Crystal Ballroom. We'll be doing 38 classic Ramon songs, and it's going to be a gas.
Hi, this is Judy Collins, and you're listening to KBOO in Portland.
Well, hello. You are listening to Running on Air, produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. I'm your host tonight, Annette Newell. Running on Air is a daily radio roundtable conversation that we're having with the people running to represent Portland. Now, in this episode, we are talking with candidates from District 1, and we would love for you to join the conversation. You can call the air room with questions for candidates. Here's the number to call. It's 503-231-8187. Again, 503-231-8187. Or you can message a question on the website. That's kboo.fm. And you can also email your questions at runningonair@kboo.org. So let's meet our wonderful candidates who are here with us today. We have Mike Sands and Joe Allen. Thank you to both of you for joining us today.
Delighted to be here, Annette.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
First, let's get a little introduction from each of you. Joe, why don't you go first and tell us a bit about yourself and why you're running for city council?
Well, as you said, my name is Joe Allen, running for City Council, District 1. I'm a woodworker. I'm a kind of a working man background. Kind of came into it almost. I didn't really foresee running for City Council until after a recent surgery I had that afforded me some time to kind of, you know, utilize learning about the issues that I was seeing in Portland. And, you know, I haven't been in Portland a very long time. I've been here for 3 years, but I'm very passionate about the city. This is the my favorite place I've ever lived. And there are a lot of challenges, a lot of issues that are present on the street in my life and, you know, surrounding us in our neighborhoods that I wanted to get involved with. And I feel very passionate about.
All right. Mike, tell us a little bit about yourself now.
Oh, thank you, Annette. I am a retired. I was a trial attorney and a law professor, and I used to sit as a Superior Court judge on a pro tem basis. So my background is law, as you can tell. And I also, like Joe, not a native here. I've been here now 12 years. Like him, I love the city. I think it's a great place to live. And I decided to run only after 2022. We had a big shakeup, as you know. There was an election that changed our entire city government. And one of the things that occurred from that is that it is now possible for 75% of the voters in District 1 to be opposed to me. They don't want me, and yet I can still win the election. And that I find to be shocking. I think it's undemocratic. And because of that, that's why I decided to get in and run this race.
Okay. Let's talk a bit about District 1, where you're both running, and what are some of the needs of this district? We're talking about the far eastern part of this city that's traditionally not gotten as much resources as some of the other parts of the city. What would you do in order to help rectify some of the problems there?
Well, what's exciting about the restructuring is that District 1 is finally going to get representation. And that is, as far as I see the job, the number one responsibility that's going to, you know, happen coming into office. For the first time, District 1 gets that voice, gets to speak to its issues, which I believe are immediately public safety, addressing homelessness, you know, all of the repeated typical Portland issues, but I think are they're magnified in District 1. I think that they need immediate attention, but in the long run, I see a lot of development that's needed there. And I think in that process, we need to understand the restructuring as it's occurring. This is an opportunity to make not just District 1, but Portland as a whole, the government a more transparent entity that's more understandable, more communicated to the citizens.
And Mike, what do you think about District 1, and what are some of the most important things that you see that need to be done?
What I noticed immediately about District 1 is that the poverty level in our district is significantly more than any other district. I was actually shocked to find out that our child poverty is twice that of District 4, which is basically on the west side. And we have problems with homelessness, as we know. We have problems with food insecurity. We have problems with drug abuse. But really, the root cause of these is the poverty level. People are living below a living wage standard. And so, in my opinion, the first thing we have to do is to try to eliminate as much as possible the people living below the poverty line.
All right. We are right now. I'm very fortunate to be with Mike Sands and Joe Allen. They are two gentlemen who are running to be your District 1 representative in Portland City Council. Actually, there will be three members from that district, from each of the four districts under our new Portland City form of government. You are listening to Running on Air. This is a production of KBOO Community Radio, and we are speaking with the candidates. We'd love to hear your questions. You can just call into the air room with questions right now for our candidates, Mike Sands and Joe Allen, 503-231-8187, or you can message us on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. So let's get back to our discussion. I'll start with you this time. What are some of the things that you would do in terms of the homelessness crisis and how it's been handled so far? I know that there have been some issues about the city and county working together. What would you do differently there?
Let me start by saying that I do not believe that being poor is a crime. Mm-hmm. There are those in our community who seem to think if you don't live up to our level, you're subject to the criminal law. I find that very disturbing. We know we have homelessness. We know we have people pitching tents all over the city. To the extent that they impair the right of way or they violate the Americans with Disabilities Act, stop people from moving about freely, that has to be removed. They do not have any right to do so. But other than that, I do not agree with the idea of arresting these people and putting them in jail, mainly because it doesn't accomplish anything. They're going to get out of jail after the taxpayers have paid for them for a week or so in jail. They're going to get out, and we're going to have the same problems all over again. The criminal sanction simply does not work. So everybody knows that we need more housing. We need more permanent housing. We need more temporary shelters. They all take money. They all take time. But we've got to have a unified plan to start working on that. I think the city and the county have had some problems coordinating. I'm looking forward to perhaps a new administration at the county. There's going to be two new people elected there. We're going to start with a clean slate here in the city. And perhaps we can work together better in the future than we've done in the past.
Mm-hmm. The Joint Office of Homeless Services worked with both the county and the city are supposed to be working together through that office to solve a lot of these issues. And there has been criticism that they haven't worked as well together as they ought to. So what would you do to help facilitate that relationship between the city and the county?
Well, one thing, just very quickly to echo what Mike was saying earlier, I've always found it very interesting that District 4 and District 1, and being polar opposites on the economic scale, tend to vote the same, which I spent a lot of time thinking about that, and I still can't come to any conclusions. But just an interesting side note, it's an interesting demographic. As far as the homelessness and how to engage with it, I actually, as a woodworker, I've been working as a woodworker 15 years. The company that I work for currently recently shifted in the past couple of years, and they kind of deleted their wood shop. So I'm not even doing what I was hired to do. They shifted to, we're manufacturing and supplying the pods that are going into the Safe Rest Villages. So for the past couple of years, I've been helping to manufacture, assemble, I've delivered them. I go to those sites and maintain them while they're occupied. So I'm embedded in the Safe Rest Villages, and I've seen that environment. It is working for people. I think it's very important that people have a door that they can close. They have a window they can open. They have their own space. If it helps anybody, I think it's worthwhile. However, I think that we need to look at how much it's helping. I think that there's bigger strides that we can make and get bigger successful numbers rather than spending so much on individual temporary housing. It's just a step. I think that a housing first approach is definitely the way to go, but I think that Portland and the government here has dropped the ball in supporting that. I think that Measure 110 was a very thoughtful vote, and I think that the people of Portland and of Oregon showed their compassion for the people that are struggling with addiction, on top of houselessness, on top of any mental issues, any of the visible aspects. But what they failed to do was follow up with the back end services. I think everybody can see that. Mm-hmm. Now with the reversal of Measure 110, which I find kind of controversial, although maybe it's needed, maybe it is time that we walk it back and we try again. I hope to see that again in the future. However, moving forward with it, I think that we owe it to provide those back-end services still. They're still needed. I think that we need to find the money that we are wasting through the inefficiency in our, you know, bureaucratic system that we have, and we're changing, and put that more directly towards finding and funding those back-end services.
So when you're building these pods, these tiny homes, what makes them special? And describe them to us. What are they like?
Well, they're about like an 8x8 space. You know, it's kind of a bedroom. There's mm-hmm. a bed with a mattress. They have a pillow. They have shelves. They have, you know, storage for their clothes and their personal belongings. There's two windows. There's heating. There's air. And it's they're actually pretty cozy, as long as, you know, they're working correctly, which there's a lot of kinks to work out when you're doing a mass level, you know, production, just numbers and numbers. You know, we would do 200 in a month. So when they go out and then they're lived in and they're kind of, you know, engaged with, you know, they get used and they need maintenance. But people are very happy there. It's a very calm, very tranquil environment there. Everybody's friendly. Everybody knows each other. And it's what's been surprising to me is seeing the difference, you know, all of the different people that are there. You know, mm-hmm. it's not just one walk of life. It's all of them.
That sounds pretty inspiring. You know, when we're talking about the legal system, which is your expertise, Mike, what would you do differently in terms of using that expertise to help people solve homelessness in this community?
I would start by saying that I've been in this situation before, mm-hmm. to the extent that I served 8 years on a city council in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I learned was that when you come into office, you have all these ideas. Then you've got to find out what is practical, what can you afford, and what is actually legal. I came in with a whole bunch of ideas, and I went to talk to the city attorney, and I had to change some of these ideas because they just weren't going to work. So I'm speaking for myself, but I think it's true of every candidate. You get elected, the first thing you want to do is listen, learn, talk to the experts, talk to the department heads, talk to the legal people at the city, and listen to what they say as you formulate your own ideas. And I can tell you, I changed a lot of ideas after getting the input from people who've been there. They've worked in the trenches. They know what they're doing in city government. So I don't have all the answers. I have some ideas. I'd like to run through these people and see if they're going to work. We've been talking about the poverty levels. Mm-hmm. Can the city do something on to help child care for the people who want to get work but don't have anyone to care for the children? Another idea, and I know this would probably be controversial, is women below the living below the poverty line, we could offer free contraceptives to them if they wanted it, because we're looking in the long run of trying to alleviate the poverty.
Well, we have a question that just came in from Joan. She's asking, how can we improve housing affordability while protecting District 1 from gentrification? Pretty good question.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, what do you think about that?
Well, what worries me about the gentrification aspect is there's 6 TIF districts that are being proposed. Those are the incremental areas, incremental tax areas that are being proposed. 3 of them are east of 82nd. 3 of them either border, you know, share space in District 1. One of my main concerns, just as a citizen and seeing that, is I've seen this before. Hmm. I would like to see them implemented in a way where either through tax initiatives, tax breaks, I mean, I want to see the government working to promote local business. Because it's like, yes, these areas need attention. And the 3 districts that are there, I mean, as I've been driving around a lot as a candidate and speaking to a lot of people, I see a lot of these areas, and they chose well. Those are areas in dire need of help. But we need to be careful how we're making that help, because we don't need a Chipotle We don't need a Starbucks. We don't need gentrification. We want the city, we want District 1 to flourish and finally show its true personality.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you answered the question for John too. How can we improve housing affordability while protecting District 1 from gentrification?
I've always acquainted gentrification with the introduction of high-scale industry that brings a lot of new wealth in and kind of forces the lower income out as they bid up prices for homes, tear down homes and build McMansions, things like that. I can't say I have yet to see that happening in District 1. Right now, I think, are so poor that almost any increase in the income level will benefit the district more than worrying about gentrification. We have to keep our eye out for it. It's possible in the future. But I don't see that as a immediate danger.
Okay.
And if I may, for Joan's part, and that was a good question, I think I got a little off on my own tangent talking about, the TIF districts. But concerning housing, one of my big kind of loftier philosophies and ideas circles around the idea of protecting residents, protecting single family homes. I think that our society at large, and it's very evident, more evident in District 1 than any other district in Portland, it's evident that real estate firms, corporate interests have run amok. They're controlling the market, and it's pricing everybody out. I think it's the front end challenge that we have to face. How to approach that, I'm still searching for ideas that I can present, because corporations, as of 15, 20 years ago, are people too, and it's trying to get around that.
According to the Supreme Court.
According to the Supreme Court, they are.
Yeah.
But it's wreaking havoc on us. I think it's one of the most important issues that's tearing apart our society.
I know some of our lawmakers, particularly our U.S. senators from Oregon, would like to stop the practice of hedge funds, for example, buying homes and properties as a portfolio investment, especially
absolutely.
When they're overseas.
Yeah.
Do you support that kind of an idea?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. But just, how, in a legal sense, and as you were saying, right. As you take office, you talk to the district attorney and you talk to all the different attorneys affiliated with the government and probably find out, it stops pretty quick. But you can't stop. It's just an obstacle. You got to move around it and find a new way. If it's requiring mortgages to be signed out in people's names, rather than an LLC, mm-hmm. Somebody has to be accountable. If it's finding a way to limit... it's a tricky one is how do we get people to stop flipping houses? Because it's just it's tearing us apart. It's wreaking havoc on the housing market. But how do you limit? If someone wants to buy a property and flip it, does that mean that somebody, a young family, is buying a house, or anybody buying a house needs to hold on to it for 3 years? They're not allowed to sell it for 3 years. I mean, it's like there's a lot to think about and a lot to consider. It's been very interesting. It's mm-hmm. I'm still searching.
Yeah.
Still searching for a way forward.
The price of housing, isn't that such a huge issue throughout Portland?
And I'd like to take off on what Joe said. It's a good idea here. Could you pass a law and just say, you buy a house in Portland, you have to live in it for 3 years? I don't think that would fly.
Right.
There's all sorts of reasons. But maybe you could tie it in to the financing. If the city had a way of providing some financing, then as a condition of the financing, if you want the money, now you have to promise to stay here for so long. So this is what I find interesting. When you get into office, you begin to think about how do we work around the problems? If they tell you, no, you can't do it this way, well, then let's see if there's another way to do it.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've been keeping tabs of who else is running in the race, and especially who's running for mayor. I think there's 28 candidates in that part of the race. Do you have a favorite candidate for mayor that you'd like to work with? And if so, who is it and why?
In District 1, I think we have about 16
candidates.
We have the lowest amount of candidates of all the districts, and
right.
being the biggest district and the one with the most, you know, concerns and urgent care, urgent needs. As far as the mayoral race, I think that Keith Wilson is a really refreshing, new personality and a new direction. That's really exciting, and especially, I wish there were more that were visible on that level. I think that the current commissioners are kind of crowding everybody out because they have the name recognition and they have the immediate history and they have the microphone every city council meeting. But I think that I think that they're good people. However, this is a new structure, mm-hmm. and to go back to the politicians that have gotten us in this place, sorry, it's just we have to change direction. We're looking for new voices and new ideas.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
I think Joe and I could run as a team here.
There you go.
Because this is what I was going to say, that right at the very beginning, I attended a forum where it was just the mayors talking to us. And the one thing I noticed, I had never met Keith Wilson before. I didn't know who he was. But as that meeting went on, I noticed how carefully he listened to whatever people were saying. And if a question was asked, he listened carefully to the question, and then he answered it. That was the surprising part, because the so-called politicians, mm-hmm. they had what they wanted to say, and they were going to say it regardless of what they were asking. So I became interested in Keith, and I've been following his campaign, as well as the other leading candidates. And I've been very disappointed in some of the other candidates just on the basis of integrity. Somebody's run up huge amounts of violations and not taken care of them, and somebody else is using taxpayer dollars to fund a Wikipedia account or to change it around. I find those to be issues of integrity.
But to be mayor, don't you think you should have some experience in running government or being in government? Is that an entry-level job for somebody?
It certainly can be. Keith has been a businessman.
Mm-hmm.
He has run a company.
Yeah.
I think having experience would be a help. But if you have the experience and you've got questions about your own integrity, then is the experience enough to put you in?
Okay. But in your case, you're saying experience is a good thing because you've actually been on a city council before and you have that experience, and that's kind of a feather in your cap.
Yeah, and I think if I were elected, we're going to have 12 council members. Very few will have had any experience in government. where my experience, I think, would help is trying to get everybody working together, keeping things flowing. And this is exactly what I did in Sacramento. I was selected by the fellow council members as vice mayor, and I used that position to reorganize the council so we were all working together, and it worked so well that they kept re-electing me. So I was elected for 4 consecutive years as vice mayor, when usually it was a one-year position.
So you must have done a good job, or they must have liked you.
I think they did.
Okay, that sounds good.
I'd like to add to that, too. I think that it's absolutely crucial. It's so important that, you know, regular people out of our society hold public office.
Right.
You don't need to be a professional. You don't have to have prior experience. This is a duty beyond voting. I think I've had the opportunity to do this, and I've been learning a lot. I mean, this has been very engaging. It's changed the trajectory of my life because I'm not turning around. I'm going to stay engaged, you know, seat or not. But this entire endeavor has shown me how important it is. We need regular people. We don't want, you know, the slick politicians, the professionals constantly, you know, experience is one thing, but making government a business is another. Hmm. We have a current government that literally calls the citizens customers. I think that's kind of impersonal and insulting.
Okay. Well, you guys have really given us a lot to think about. And if people want to call, I would definitely welcome some more questions from the listeners out there. Again, the number to call is 503-231-8187. You're listening to Running on Air, produced by KBOO. We're going to take a quick musical break for a couple minutes, and then we'll come right back. And you can ask questions of Mike Sands and Joe Allen, who are running for Portland City Council District 1.
Well, support for Running on Air comes from KBOO members and the League of Women Voters. More information about the candidates on your ballot can be found on the League of Women Voters of Portland's website. It's terrific. You should check it out. It's lwvpdx.org. The League has videos of candidate interviews and forums, as well as links to candidates' written answers to questions and explanations of the ballot measures. Again, you can check that website out at lwvpdx.org. And welcome back to Running on Air with Mike Sands and Joe Allen. We were just going into the break and talking about how much you two agree on a lot of stuff, and you probably would work well together on the city council. Do you think that it's going to be easy to have 12 people who are probably all strong personalities with a lot of ideas work together in that format with so many more people being on the council?
This is where I think perhaps a lack of experience by many of these people may make it a little more difficult. Mm-hmm. And I say that because my experience in Sacramento, we changed from citywide to districts, and that caused a huge turnover in the membership. But most of the people who were coming on had some kind of governmental experience, and we all knew we had to work together, and it ended up being a very cooperative group. I hope we would do it, but we're coming from so many different places with so many people. Actually, 12 is going to be a fairly large group to try to organize. So I'm hoping we all go into it with the idea that helping each other furthers the whole program.
Mm-hmm. Joe, what do you think about that, working with a group of 12?
Well, I think, you know, we've had the current structure of government for so long in Portland, 80 years, 90 years, that it's just kind of ingrained into, you know, kind of the soul of Portland. So it's going to take a minute for everyone to understand the new system and what the new jobs are. Fortunately, personally, I think it's a relief that, you know, one person out of 12, you're not in charge of everything. And also, my ideas aren't the most important ideas. I'm here to represent the people that have elected me, and I'm here to represent the people that haven't elected me. I think that there's also aspects to look at. One of the first jobs that the city council is going to have is to elect president. So someone's going to have to, you know, be a clear, concise, articulate voice that's going to earn the votes of the rest of the council in order to lead. And hopefully that leader, you know, comes quickly and clearly. But also, you know, we're working, it depends on who the mayor is and how well is a group of 12 people going to work with the executive side of the local government. We're going to be forming policy looking at the future. The mayor is going to be executing the policies as they are and as they change. So I think that with the new structure, there's a lot of air to expand. You know, there's a lot of space. It's not, you don't have to feel everything at once. We take one thing at a time, we discuss them, and hopefully everybody comes with the right intention of representing their districts and representing Portland as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to ask you gentlemen about some breaking news that just came in this afternoon that Oregon's Secretary of State and Governor are calling for inactivating voter registrations and calling for an independent audit after they learned of additional errors from the Oregon Driver and Motor Vehicle Safety's Division. Today, the DMV released its after-action report and they ID'd 302 individuals being registered to vote who did not provide proof of their eligibility. Now, in response, what they're calling for is to inactivate all 302 voter registrations and do an external audit of the entire motor voter system. What do you think of this this new wrinkle that just happened in our election this year?
It sounds to me like basically an expansion. I think they had 1,200 earlier.
Right.
So now it's 1,500 they've mm-hmm. discovered. and that's unfortunate. It's unfortunate, I think, because it's not the people who were trying to cheat. I think it's the system and what they ask for. If they ask somebody for a passport and they turned in, showed them a foreign passport and it was accepted, it's not the voter's problem, it's the system. I think that the governor's right, that they need to thoroughly investigate the process that the DMV is using and probably set up some further protocols to protect against this. And then I would have to say, even 1,500 is too many. But when you think how many millions of voters we actually have, it's really a very small amount. I think the system is overall still very good, yeah. Even though we have to strengthen the checking of these undocumented people.
Yeah, I think it's important to point out, like, we have 3 million registered voters. So this is, we're talking about a tiny percentage. But then again, there have been some very close races where maybe they would have made a difference in a few. So what are your thoughts about this, Joe?
Well, it's a small number comparatively. It's a large number historically because I've never seen voter fraud on that level, even on a national level. We've, you know, as much as certain parties and politicians want to bemoan, you know, our registration tactics, we've just never seen fraud. I would think that there's something going on with the system there, and I'm always for an audit. I mean, I think that's the biggest tool that we can use towards transparency. And to see a Democrat, Kotek, calling for an audit is very interesting because typically it's been the right that has been asking for voter ID laws, which I personally am vehemently against. I think it's just kind of a new version of gerrymandering, and it's a way to intimidate, you know, minorities and getting underrepresented people away from the polls. So for her to make that call, it's very interesting. And I really do wonder, as a citizen, what is going on there? Like, why, what's going on at the DMV?
I would like to comment one thing here.
Sure.
I'm just concerned. Joe used the term fraud. And to me, fraud kind of indicates an intent to do wrong, an intent to fool people. And I'm not convinced that either the voters who were signed up improperly or even the state employees who were running this through DMV had any kind of improper intent. The audit would show us, but I suspect it's more an inadvertence, a poorly designed system which wasn't working properly, rather than an intent on somebody to skewer the election results.
Absolutely. And that's actually the point I was trying to get to, perhaps poorly. I just don't believe that, the fraud was the intention. I think it's a systematic error, something wrong with the system. Because I, historically, 1,200, 1,500 people, we have not seen those numbers where people are trying to, break the law.
Or rig an election.
Whatever the issue may be.
Yeah.
And I'm curious what the actual, error or issue is, that they're not showing proper identification.
Yeah, I think that the first batch they were talking about, it was like a pull down menu issue with the way they were inputting it into the system. There was an error with that. But this batch, they haven't said exactly what the issue
is. So it sounds like it is purely just a problem with the system itself.
Yeah, that is what it sounds like. So, but overall, how do you think Oregon's electoral system works and functions in terms of the mail-in balloting and the way we can fill out our ballots around a kitchen table, which is not the case in most of America? You have to show up and wait and in line, and some states they don't even let people bring you water in the line.
Right, right.
So Oregon makes it a lot easier than many other states.
I think it's fantastic.
Yeah,
I think it's great. I think Election Day should be a national holiday. I mean, I think that's obvious to a lot of people. I still don't understand why we can't implement that even on a state level. Mm-hmm. And I think that, putting ballots in people's hands in the places where they live, there's not that, kind of chore of getting out of the house, waiting in line, and then having people mess with that system where they're trying to eliminate the places that you can go to so that it does make longer lines and does make it more difficult to go vote. Putting the votes in people's homes that's where it's at.
And Mike, any comments you have about the current system we have in Oregon for voting?
I think it's great, and I'm kind of proud that Oregon was the first to actually do it, because it's now being copied by many other states. The entire West Coast is doing this, and despite claims made by some people in the politics, there haven't really been any significant problems with it. All of our election officials, from Secretary of State down to the county election officials, have all verified that it runs smoothly and that there's no problems with it, really. So I would like to see it become a national, Election Day is national. Why not mandate that we use mail-in voting and absentee ballots? It works.
It's a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a bit about climate change, because I know Althea Billings, our news director here at KBOO, has done some research about what was on people's minds, and that was definitely the top issue for voters in the Portland area, that they want to see something done meaningfully about climate. And what do you think that the city could actually do in terms of making a difference?
It always makes me think of, when COVID was going on, those were really dark times. They're very challenging for everybody, but I don't think anybody can argue. It was really nice to look out and see a clear blue sky and to hear, see less smog and see less pollution. Of course, that was a special moment. That's, you know, long since passed. But I think it's actually what drives it's what drives the conversation about getting off of our dependence with cars, which I see as, you know, only a fraction of what's applying there. However, I think that that's going to be more and more of a challenge as we talk about affordable housing. We start talking about infill in neighborhoods, you know, if people can get, you know, if they can construct an ADU, if they can rent out their garage, if they can, you know, any of these creative ideas that people are coming up with, we don't have the parking for it. And that's going to be a whole different challenge. I mean, that will change the face of the city in a bad way. Mm-hmm. So I think that embracing, you know, kind of like a bicycle approach is going to be very important holistically for everything. Mm-hmm. However, we also need to look at, you know, the industrial side. And I admittedly, I don't know what percentage of that is on the city level. But what is so frustrating to me is, you know, I don't really have a grasp of what we can even do on a city level. Of course, we can do our thing. We can feel good about that. And that's a great thing that we can celebrate. But what's disparaging is I don't know on a state level or even on a national level. I mean, what can we do besides maybe hope to be a beacon, you know, hope to be an example to other people to live this way and see the benefits of it?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any thoughts on that, Mike?
Well, I share Joe's, maybe the word skepticism isn't a good word, but the idea of just what we can do that will have a major impact. I know some people are advocating planting more trees. Definitely, District 1 is short on trees. We could, I think, benefit greatly from planting more trees. How much of an impact that will make, I don't know, but it probably will be a step forward. We talk about eliminating car use. Well, we've seen studies in other places where they've tried to impose a tax if you drive into downtown and you do these other things. So far, I have not seen any positive results actually coming from that. You get a lot of backlash.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, whether it really contributes to helping the climate change issue, I'm not sure yet. Mm-hmm. So what I think would be important is to have a council that is open to new suggestions, to listen to the scientists and the engineers and hearing their ideas and being open to trying new things that we haven't done before.
So and we want a cleaner and greener community, but at the same time, we want good jobs. So can we achieve both of those at the same time would be the challenge, right?
Well, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's, you know, we have the private sector that's screaming that we have a job crisis. We need to create more jobs. And we have a government that is saying we need to employ more people. So I don't see how the two can't work. I think it's a failure of our transportation system, especially in District 1. Just like Mike was saying, I wouldn't put it on the people. You know, I wouldn't find our way out of this. I wouldn't tell people, if people have jobs, you need a car to get to work. That's a failure of the city. You know, I would take a train to work if I could. I can't. You know, I'm 2-3 miles from the local MAC stop, which would take me downtown. I work in Northwest Industrial. To take public transportation there would be 3 hours out of my day. Hmm. It's just too much. But I'd like to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I will personally help, because if I get elected to city council, I will use MAX to get to work.
Good for you. Okay.
I agree.
You can make that pledge.
I'd have to take my bike to get to the station, which I'm down for. But yeah, that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Let's talk for a moment about crime and gun violence. I know that's been a big issue in Portland, and I know the police have have made some strides, and people, some of the folks who are currently in the city council have been working really hard on getting some results from trying to prevent gun violence, and it looks like they're having some impact where it is going down. But what needs to be done to make the streets safer and prevent a lot of the violence that we've seen?
Well, the first thing that I would do is to get a Supreme Court that learns how to read, so that we find out what it means to maintain a well-regulated militia. But that's not going to happen in my lifetime, unfortunately. I think Oregon generally is trying. I think the measure that I forget the number now, but the one that's imposed what I thought were very reasonable limitations, got tied up in a small county with a mm-hmm. they handpicked a judge, but now it's before the Court of Appeal, and I'm really hopeful. I followed the issues there, and I think there's a good chance that we may be able to actually impose some reasonable limitations. Nothing takes guns away, but there are reasonable limitations and training involved, and so I'm hoping that that will help. I also think that we suffered a real blow when the city council took a substantial amount of money out of the police budget, and we're understaffed, significantly understaffed, and it's becoming harder to recruit new people. We need more policemen, and we need them to be trained well.
What do you think about, what are some of your ideas for reducing the crime and violence?
I definitely agree that, you know, the Portland Police Bureau, as they've said, they need 200 more employees, they need 200 more officers. They need to be on the street. We need a more community-led police force, more meaningful. That also comes with kind of a constitutional shift in their approach to their work, where I think that some of the training under the DOJ settlement is helping. It's slow. I don't know why it's taken so long. Why did it take so long to get cameras, you know, the body cameras?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was just a huge bloated bureaucratic process, and it's just now finally being initiated.
Yeah, the last city in America to do it, I think, is Portland, major city.
Hard to believe that, mm-hmm. that we're looking at this.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that I think the Portland Police Bureau, you know, deserve it or not, they've been through the ringer. They've been handcuffed from doing their jobs. And I think it's time that we recognize, it's hard to do, but it's time to recognize that they've been alienated. I think that they are discouraged, and I can't see a return to what led to the DOJ settlement, you know, almost 10 years ago, 10
mm-hmm.
years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we need to expand more meaningful programs and be able to see on a public level transparency of what is taking effect. We have Operation Ceasefire. I believe that needs more support. You know, it's not just about Portland Street Response, which a lot of candidates talk about. Everybody seems to talk about that like it's this magic wand. It's going to save everything because it's this outreach of, you know. But when crimes are being committed, and crimes are being committed, we need an engaging, meaningful police force. But that also, you know, we don't need stormtroopers. We don't need a return to the brutality. We need a different approach. I think that looking at other cities, you know, there's a lot of other cities that have made this change, and you could see their results. You know, it's I would want to promote and support more public level outreach of Operation Ceasefire, which, like, you know, gun buybacks, it's something as simple as that, where it's a community engaged effort.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it's just in my neighborhood. You know, I'd like to see more police. I'd like to feel safer and know that someone is there to help if I needed it. It's like every time I go anywhere, I see crime after crime after crime being committed. I don't see people being pulled over. You know, I just like everybody else, every time I leave the house, I get cut off by the guy that doesn't have any license plates. And it's like, where is the law? And I understand after COVID, that all changed. But it's, this is like the last holdout of that aspect of COVID, where it's like, where are the police? Why aren't they helping? I think here, you know, sitting in on different meetings, you know, I've sat in on a couple of the TAC meetings, the Training Advisement Committee, and it's been really interesting to hear their conversations, and they're very frustrated. They don't get communication from on a federal level. They're told to follow state guidelines. When they ask for those, they're ignored. And I think that, you know, most of the people that they called on to do reports, they either just had complaints where they can't find the information that they need, they can't find the direction, or they threw their hands up like, we don't even know what we're supposed to do here. We can't get anybody to interact with us. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you've got the public that's, you know, just hammering on you, which, like I said, deserved or not. But then from above, I mean, it's like from every direction, we've got a struggling police force that needs support. And I think that we could increase their budget, actually, with caveats. Mm-hmm. If they were doing the meaningful work, I'd want to encourage it and make it an appealing job to have.
Well, I took a look at the Portland budget for the police, and it's gone up every year. We haven't defunded the police.
We have not.
So we're paying more and more every year for the police.
What's bothered me ever since I've moved here is kind of the revolving door at the top of the police administration. I can't even count how many police chiefs in the last 12 years since I've been here.
Yeah.
But, you know, under the old system we had, the mayor took the responsibility, and every time, every mayor takes control of the police department. None of them, since I've been here, have had any
law enforcement
experience at all. And hopefully, under the new system, what Sacramento did is that the city manager appointed the police chief, and the council had to approve it. But when it was properly vetted, we had no problem with the selections being made. But we need to get professional administrators in charge of these different departments, and getting leaders who will then stay in the job and build up the morale. The police department, I understand, has terrible morale problems. I'd like to see that improved.
Yeah, they're asking for $2 million more at the city council this week, Althea just mentioned. So,
I think their budget currently is about $250 million,
yeah,
which compared to some other bureaus, is very small in comparison.
Yeah.
So they need help.
They're expecting possible protests during election season.
Especially if so-and-so wins.
So... Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the election. So I wanted to just ask you one last question about what would be your ideal first day on the job? Say you're elected, what would be your top priority day one you're on the job for Portland City Council?
Top priority?
Yeah.
I mean, my top priority from day one all the way to the last day is just going to be representing the people and making sure that I'm not inserting myself between them and the services that they paid for. As far as the first day, I mean, that'd be pretty exciting. I think my top priority would be getting to know and forge just relationships with the other people that are sitting in the council and making sure that we're starting from a good point. We understand each other's intentions, and we all kind of share, you know, the same kind of goals, which I think that most of all the candidates that I've met, they are passionate. You know, I'm very excited about there being multiple people to represent a district. It's not all on one person. It is a committee. And I think that's a really interesting way to go. Day one, I'd be looking to communicate that representation and bring it to the people that are on the board.
Tell people in District 1 you're there for them.
Okay. Absolutely.
That sounds like a good way to start. How about you? What do you think, Mike?
Well, I'm sorry I didn't have more time to develop this, but starting on day one, I'm going to make an effort to see to it that we get a measure on the ballot that guarantees every city official who is elected has received the support of a majority of the voters, not 25%. It's going to take work with the other council members, but that's my top priority.
Okay. And if people get out there and vote for you, what can they expect?
What they can expect in the strength of a district form of government is that it gives you access to greater constituent services. The people in the district know to whom they can look for help. And I know from personal experience, that's a real advantage for the constituents.
Wonderful. Well, thanks to both of you. I'm so excited that you chose to join us here, Mike Sands and Joe Allen. And best of luck to you in the election.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. It's been enjoyable.
Yes.
And you've been listening to Running on Air, produced at KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. I've been here with Mike Sands and Joe Allen from District 1. You can find all of the episodes of Running on Air on the KBOO website. That's kboo.fm/runningonair. Episodes are also available wherever you get your podcasts. Our producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Our editor is Eric Loeschner. And tune into the next episode of Running on Air tomorrow at 10 a.m. It will be with candidates from District 2. I've been your host tonight, Annette Newell. Thanks so much for listening. It's been a pleasure.
This is KBOO Portland.
Here we go again, it's the game we love.
Tune in on the first and third Tuesday of the month at 11 a.m. for Winner's Bias, a new show exploring the culture around tabletop gaming. From game nights to conventions, Nate